Well, I want to say a great welcome to everybody who is with us this weekend. Welcome to all of our campuses and those of you who may be joining online. Thanks for spending some time with us. It is good to be together as we're in this series called No Strings Attached. And we're talking about the power of and the purpose of making and keeping commitments in our lives. We're also talking about the fact that in our day and age, there's a lot of suspicion around commitment. People are becoming more and more kind of commitment avoidant, commitment phobic. And nowhere is this more prevalent and apparent than in the area of relationships. So this weekend we're just going to be talking about relationships and commitment. Some of you know that today is a day where we, in our culture, kind of celebrate love and relationship. You know what today is? Anybody? You're going to need to know for the rest of your day. This is an important one, right? Valentine's Day. Psychologists actually say there's two kinds of people. People who love Valentine's Day and people who are sick of people who love Valentine's Day. So wherever you are on that spectrum, you are welcome here. There's a lot of different stories and a lot of different things going on in life and relationships. I know from my own journey the ups and downs of relationships. I will never forget the day I got married, August 2nd, 2014. As some of you know, that was kind of a long time coming for me. I actually remember being in high school and praying, God, if you will help me find a woman who loves you and who will love me and who I can spend the rest of my life with. That was in 1992. So I was just, you can imagine like how excited I was the day that I saw Nina walking down the aisle. And when she took my hand, when she put a ring on my finger, and when she said those amazing words, I take you. For better or for worse, I take you. You know, there's few words that are more powerful, more profound, more meaningful, even more anxiety-producing than those words, I take you. I remember as my wedding day approached, amidst all the excitement, anticipation, I became profoundly aware not just of the woman I was about to marry, but of the commitment I was about to make. I take you, for better or for worse. And it's not that, you know, I loved her, I wanted to marry her, but I had never made a promise like that before. And it got me thinking about kind of all the what ifs. Anyone else ever wrestle with kind of the what ifs in life? I thought, well, what if I change? What if she changes? What if our feelings change? What if we have too many disagreements? What if she thinks the toilet paper is supposed to go like this way when the Bible clearly says it goes this way, right? What will we do in those moments? How will commitment survive? I take you for better or for worse. And it kind of got me thinking, like, why do human beings do this? Why do we do this? Interestingly enough, more and more people today say that maybe we shouldn't. More and more people are saying, you know, human beings, we aren't really biologically suited for this kind of commitment. I mean, very few animals in the animal kingdom make this kind of life partnership commitment. Emotionally, people change. They feel things differently over time. People move on. They change what they want, or they want different things out of life. Life's unpredictable. What happens when circumstances change, or when our situation changes, or experiences of life change kind of our hearts, which is why more and more people are saying, I think it might be best, it might be safest to just kind of avoid commitment, to put it off, to not keep it. People will move in together, but they'll put off marriage. People will hook up, but not date or take relationships that seriously. People are looking for that no strings attached or friends with benefits or Netflix and chill, which I just recently learned has nothing to do with watching TV. So be careful with that one, okay? And it's interesting. Technology makes this just more and more convenient for us. You know, when I was in college, if you wanted to ask someone out, you actually had to pick up the phone, which was oddly attached to the wall, and call someone. You know, it took guts, it took courage, it took emotional intelligence, which is why I never did it, but that's what people would do. Today, you can get on your phone, and there's an app that helps you meet up, hook up, shack up, break up, all with the touch of a button. But here's the thing, technology is not our problem. Our way of thinking about commitment and relationships is our problem. living in a culture where it seems like the most prevalent concept is that the best way to enjoy life or freedom or autonomy or sex is to avoid the constraints or limitations of commitment. And there's real data we can see that kind of supports this. Just to give you some numbers, you can see the marriage rate in the United States over the last 30 years just declining, just kind of declining down over the years. And we're learning more and more about people's perspective on marriage. And a survey from 2010 showed that almost half of the young adults between the ages of 18 and 29 in our country, almost half think that marriage has become obsolete, that it's just obsolete at this point. We're replacing for better or for worse with I take you at least until I don't want to anymore. You know, it's interesting, over 2 million weddings will take place this year. And statistics would say that about half will make it to 15 years. About half. And that doesn't include the number of couples who stay married but whose commitment kind of runs cold or grows distant, grows stale. And here's the thing, this is about far more than just data. This is about people. This is about you. This is about me. This is about our hearts, our lives. This is about what we feel matters most. And I know, there's a lot of different stories and circumstances right now, even in this room or listening right now. Some of you are single. Some of you are married. Some of you are single but want to be married. Some of you are in a relationship. Some of you are just out of a relationship. Some of you are in kind of a friends with benefits thing. Some of you are friends without benefits, which sounds worse, but it's actually a lot healthier. Some of you have lost someone you love. There's a lot to cover, a lot to think about. But here's what's true for all of us. It's real, it's personal, and it's vulnerable, isn't it? And here's the thing, I feel that too. I feel that too. When John and I talked about this message a few weeks ago, I said, John, are you sure you don't want to teach on this topic? I mean, I think it would be such a blessing for folks to hear from you. You have so many years and years and years and years of life experience. But the truth is, part of the vulnerability is just that my relational past is so far from perfect. And I don't just stand up here to talk about it. I stand with you in the mess of it, in the hurt of it. There's decisions that I would make differently. There's people that I would treat differently. Which is why we need to come back and talk about this word commitment and what it really means. And it's not just about whether or not you or I have the strength to commit. I think sometimes we hear that word and we think, okay, this is going to be one of those talks. It's all about, do I have the strength? Do I have the righteousness? Do I have the courage? Do I have what it takes? It's actually something different. There's different questions we need to wrestle with. We need to wrestle with why commitment actually matters. And then what commitment looks like in different seasons of life or different stages of life. And then how to keep our commitments. How do we actually do that? So for the rest of our time, I just want to walk through kind of these three questions, the why, the what, and the how when it comes to committed relationships. Starting with the why. Why should people commit to one another? Isn't this just kind of old-fashioned? Aren't people too unpredictable? Isn't it safer to avoid commitment? Isn't it safer to avoid just getting hurt? I actually read a study about why more and more teenagers are having sexual encounters without any relational involvement. And one of the reasons was, and I'm not making this up, because they said being with a real person was difficult and even annoying. Ever met anyone who's not annoying at some point in time, somewhere, right? Is this really what it boils down to? Are committed relationships just too risky or burdensome or difficult? Is it possible that we're just going to get hurt? Well, yes, of course it is. But here's what's missing in this conversation about the risk of commitment. What's missing is there's a much greater risk out there, and it's the risk of avoiding commitment. Over the long term, over the long haul, the risk of avoiding committed relationships is far greater. It's far greater. There's a research project, many of you will know about this, called the Grant Study. It's the longest running study on human development in history. Longest running study. It began in 1938 at Harvard University. 268 individuals were studied for over 75 years, from their teens into their 80s and 90s. And the goal was very simple. They wanted to find out, objectively as they could, what produces lasting happiness. Like, which parts of life will actually produce lasting joy and contentment? Wouldn't that be great to know? And they followed these individuals for literally 75 years. They followed their health patterns, medical records. They did brain scans. They interviewed spouses and families. There's tens of thousands of pages of data. Here's what they found. They found that happiness did not increase with greater wealth or more success or higher achievement. And Bay Area, we just need to pause and let this soak in for a moment. These real lives, real data, this was not done by a church or by a pastor. It's not a Christian study. They found that happiness in no way correlated with greater wealth or more success or higher achievement. They also found that happiness had nothing to do with fame or reputation or even social impact, even the amount of difference a person can make in the world. What they found is this: happiness correlated to one consistent factor over and over and over through a lifetime, and it's lasting relationships. Lasting relationships. Not sure, Dr. George Valiant, who led the study for over 30 years, said that their research proved there are two pillars of happiness. These are his words. One is love. The other is finding a way of coping with life that does not push love away. In other words, happiness is found in committed relationships, in love, and living in such a way that doesn't run, doesn't hide, doesn't break, but keeps close, committed relationships, which, by the way, should be no surprise because Scripture has been teaching this for thousands of years. When God created human beings, he said, "It is not good for the man to be alone," which is absurd if you think about that statement in a world without sin. I mean, think about it. The markets were up, the rent was down, the Niners were winning. Everything was just as it should be in the world, except for one thing. Adam lacked a relationship, and not just a casual friendship or a friends with benefits. He lacked a committed relationship. Someone that was committed to him, someone he was committed to. And the text goes on to frame it this way. It says, "This is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they became one flesh." This is the language of commitment. The goal is commitment. Some of you will know the old King James version of this text where it talks about leaving and cleaving. The man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, and that cleaving portrays the context of a risky stepping out and making a commitment. And that day, a home was not just where you lived until you went to college, or in our context, until you were 30 or 40. Home was the place for education, economic stability, learning a trade. To leave one's father and mother was to put one's life and livelihood at risk, all for the sake of commitment. Really? You see, God, from the very beginning, God designed us for and to live in the context of committed relationships. It was something that was supposed to be so good for us and so right. And I know, for so many, it feels like it has gone so wrong. And our world is filled with such brokenness and pain. And we'll come back to that and what to think about that. But the why commitment? Because it's a good thing, and you're made for it. Which leads us to the what question. What kind of commitments are we talking about? What kind of commitments are we really talking about? Is this really just about marriage? Is this one of those talks just going to say, well, you know, if you're married, great. If not, better luck next time. Is there any part of this that applies to life beyond that? And the answer is absolutely yes, it does. You know, one of the weaknesses in a lot of churches, and it's not always intentional, but one of the weaknesses is speaking to single people as if they're somehow second-class citizens. I remember people saying to me for so much of my single life, "Scotty, you seem like such a great guy, so how come you're single?" As if it was sort of a disease I needed to sort of get rid of. But here's the thing, the Bible doesn't speak about being single as a problem to be corrected. In fact, Christianity was the first major religion to uphold singleness as an honorable, faithful way to live. And here's the thing, Jesus was single. The Apostle Paul was single. He wrote about the gift and blessing of being single. So if we're going to talk about committed relationships, the first place we want to go to is, well, how did Jesus live out commitment in his life? And he did through in a very important way. It's kind of the first what of committed relationships. He did through this thing of committed friendship. Committed friendship. Not having a large you know, social network, not having 10,000 friends on Facebook, not making sure he had the most likes on Instagram, committed friendships. A lot of rabbis would teach, they would lead, they would cast vision. Jesus focused on friendship. Have you ever noticed that through his life? He had close friends, committed friends. Having 12 disciples, yes, it was symbolic of the 12 tribes of Israel, but here's the thing, he needed just a few close friends. People he was committed to, people he would spend time with, people he was loyal to. And he once told them directly, I don't call you servants, I call you friends. Friends. You know, and there's, think about John, who called himself the disciple that Jesus loved, disciple who knew that there was deep friendship with this person. And we see this loyalty play out even in the most difficult moments. When Judas comes to betray Jesus, when he brings soldiers to arrest him, Jesus says, do what you came for, friend. And for a long time, I read this as sort of a kind of biting sarcasm, sort of a implicit, understated attack. But I don't think that's what it is. I think Jesus is expressing what's true for him is that Judas is still his friend. That even when Judas isn't loyal, Jesus is. Jesus understands the practice and value of committed relationship. Even when this man turns on him and, you know, gives him that kiss of betrayal, do what you came for, friend. My friendship with you doesn't change. My loyalty to you doesn't change. My love for you doesn't change. We'll flag that. We're going to come back to that. But you know, I think about it in my own life. I can't remember a day that I didn't long for a close, committed friend. You know that feeling? Longing for someone that knows me, that cares for me, that's not part of their network. I'm not a stepping stone to something else. According to a study in 2006, only one out of every four Americans, or one out of every four Americans lacks a close friendship, a best friend. Meaning they don't have someone in their life that they can call. They don't have someone to turn to in crisis or pain or tragedy. One out of four. That is not okay. And some of you experience, you feel that burden even now. Writer of Proverbs puts it this way. These are real serious words. He says, one who has unreliable friends soon comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. So let me ask you, who's that friend in your life? Who's that person in your life? For some of you, that may be why you're here this week and God nudging you to say you need to focus on relationships and friendships in your life. You can't go through it alone anymore. Who's that friend in your life? Equally important question, for whom are you that friend? To whom have you given permission to call you at any time, to ask for anything, to interrupt your busy life with a request, a need, something that you need to make a sacrifice for, to tell you the whole truth, not just the truth you want to hear? You know, sometimes I think we long for but lack friendship because we're so focused on career and getting ahead and reputation, and those things are okay, but they cannot replace our need for committed friendship. And we see it in Jesus' life. That's one of the what's, one kind of commitment. There's folks of you who are in a different season of life. Some of you are single, but you're looking for someone to commit to. So what kind of commitments are important there? You know, and I spent a lot of time dating. I kind of was in the dating world for over 20 years. Dating's kind of an odd thing. The longer you do it, kind of the worse you feel at it. It's one of the weird things like that. And there's a lot of confusion in the church about dating. You know, I grew up with all the books. There's things like books like the Ten Commandments of Dating and I Kiss Dating Goodbye and I Kiss Books on Dating Goodbye. And there's just, you know, all that stuff. And almost all the messages you hear about dating is about the commitment to find the right person, how to find the right person. There's actually a show on TV right now where a man or woman will actually date 20, 24 people at the same time under the guise of finding the right person. Anyone know the show I'm talking about? Don't look at me like I'm the only person that watches this, okay, everybody? Most people think a healthy relationship is about finding the right person, as if our job is just to narrow down off the menu. But the truth is, a healthy relationship involves two people who are committed to becoming the right person. Commitment is less about who you find and more about who you are and who you're willing to become or who you're choosing to become. I read kind of a painful story about a young woman who grew up in a religious home. She went to church. She tried to be the good girl, and she thought that was the way that she was going to meet the one and find the right person. But it just didn't seem to happen. She struggled to find the right person. So she took a different approach. She kind of immersed herself in the hookup culture and had a lot of kind of casual encounters and nights she could hardly remember. And she thought eventually she'd just find that person out there if she just kind of put herself out there, had a good time. Until one night at a party, she met a man who had really everything she was looking for. He was attractive and humble and talented and charismatic and deep faith. But their conversation didn't really go anywhere. It didn't seem that he was that interested. And then she went home that night and had this painful, painful epiphany. She realized that the man that she was looking for wasn't looking for a woman like her. And she said it was one of the most painful but life-changing gifts to wake up to the fact that her journey towards commitment wasn't just about being out there having a good time thinking I'll just happen upon the right person. It's about her need to commit to becoming the right person. And so she started to take that seriously and started to work on her character and change some of her friendships. She got out of the hookup scene. She even got a counselor. She began to prepare herself for the commitment she wanted to make. As a pastor I've heard say it, she wanted to become who the person she's looking for is looking for. And it changed her life. And just to say it, kind of more on the subject, this is why God's plan for sex as an expression of a life-uniting commitment is so, so, so important and so misunderstood by so many. Someone once recently sent me an email saying, because people are waiting so long to get married, it is naive and even ridiculous to suggest that a person should wait to have sex because people need that kind of intimacy now. And you know, I got married when I was 38. I understood the dilemma that they were writing about. But the first thing I want to say is, yes, I understand we all need intimacy. That's part of what we're talking about. But what kind of intimacy are you actually describing? The intimacy of knowing a person isn't committed to you? The intimacy of them saying, I take you at least until tomorrow? Is that what you need? Is that what this is about? But here's the thing, even if you're not a Christian, even if you're here and you think, I'm not sure the Bible really gets this, I'm not sure the church is really caught up on the culture, I'm not sure this isn't just old-fashioned or obsolete kind of thinking, secular studies today confirm that people who sleep together or live together are actually less dedicated both before and even after they marry, if they marry at all. In other words, that journey, that decision doesn't lead us towards more healthy, committed relationship. It actually leads us away from that. Which is why God designed sex to be part of a life-united, committing relationship. Is this countercultural? Yes, absolutely. Will people think you're strange if you live this way? Yes, absolutely. Will it take hard work, honest conversation, lots of trust in God? Yes, absolutely. But will it give you the best chance at a lifetime of connection and trust and intimacy? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Which raises a great question. What if you've fallen short? What if I've fallen short? What if I've messed this up? What if I'm in a relationship that's not healthy? Well, you're in the right place. It may not feel that way. Churches can be kind of crass, sometimes judgmental, sometimes kind of pushing people away if they live differently, if their relationships don't kind of look a certain way. But I got to ask you, if that's been your experience, don't just take your church experience. Take Jesus' life into account. Think about how he treated people whose relationships were far from perfect, which, by the way, is everybody. There was grace, there was love, there was listening, there was acceptance, and then there was a vision of life, a better way of life that he would call people into and empower them to live. And that's an invitation for a lot of you. Maybe some of you are feeling that sense of maybe there's something you want to change in your life around this. You cannot do it on your own, but Jesus can help. Jesus can help. Which leaves just a few moments to talk about marriage itself. You know, marriage is not only an expression of the commitment God calls people into. It's this unique and beautiful and rich and challenging picture of what faithfulness is really like. It's two people saying to each other, I take you for better or for worse. And not just on that wedding day. Though it's interesting, people spend a lot of money, a lot of time planning a wedding and often so little time and energy actually preparing for that marriage. We think about, oh, it's about making a commitment. No, it's about how to keep that commitment. And that's not easy. every day after, one little decision at a time, when one person has to forgive the other, when one person has to courageously say the hard thing to the other, when one person has to learn to listen to the other, when one has to shift their priorities for the other, when one has to make sacrifices for the other. And I know it's messy. I know it's hard. I know a lot of you have been through broken marriages and betrayal, and these things are not always as clean and simple and tidy as we'd want them to be. But in the process of keeping commitment, something deeper and greater is actually forged in our lives, and it's this beautiful thing called trust. Because, see, here's the thing. You can't live without trust. You can't live your life and trust no one. It feels safer. It feels easier. Some of you have been burned, and so you're not thinking, I'll just step back. I don't have to trust anybody anymore. You can't live that way. And then the next question is, well, then how do I learn to trust? How do I build trust? And that's where commitment is so important. There's a writer named Lou Smeads who has this amazing book called Learning to Live the Love We Promise. And he writes about it this way. He says, it takes personal commitment to create trust. It's interesting because I never would have thought that. I would have thought, you know, to have trust, it would take someone, you know, making sure I have a guarantee that it's going to work out, making sure that I know there's never going to be pain, making sure that I'm always going to get my way. No, no, it just takes personal commitment to create trust. And not just a vow spoken a year, 10 years, a lifetime ago, but commitment reborn every day by a reliable presence, renewed by acts of care, resurrected by generous forgiving. Our commitment to someone in caring love is the only guarantee we can give, the only basis for trust. That's why God created marriage. That's why God created committed friendship, so we could love and be loved, so we could trust and be trusted, so we could forgive and be forgiven. And I gotta say, I hear this a lot, the perspective that commitment's restrictive or confining, you're gonna lose your freedom. What kind of freedom lies down the road of when there's no one you can count on or no one that you can depend on or no one who's going to be there? You see, commitment doesn't lead to less freedom. It leads to more freedom. It's not less secure. It's more secure, which leads to kind of our third question, which is, how do we do this? How do we keep our commitments? Well, here's the thing. On your own, of your own strength, based on your willpower or your religious dedication, you can't. You can't. I've watched people try. I've watched myself try. You can't do it on your own. God did not create committed relationships so that we could live on our own without him. He created committed relationships so we would recognize every day our need for him. For his love, for his grace, for his renewal. We don't commit because we're strong and noble. We commit because there's a God who is committed to us. I love how it's framed in the New Testament. The writer John says, we love because he first loved us. And the most important word is not love. It's the word first. Jesus went first. Jesus went first. He committed to you first. He made a promise to you first. Before you step into any relationship of any kind, Jesus made a promise to you first that he would never leave, that he would never turn his face, that he would never walk away, that he would always be there. And I know life, it gets pretty messy, doesn't it? Some of you are in a marriage that feels not like it used to, maybe cold or more callous. Some of you have been holding on to that scorecard in your relationship, you know, that card where you kind of keep a tally of who's done more rights than wrong and what you get to do with that. Some of you may be living with a secret or a source of shame. You just feel like you can't tell anyone. Some of you are working so hard to raise kids or get ahead in your work. You feel like that relationship's just on a distant second priority. Some of you going through a divorce, you've been through a divorce. This conversation feels like, I'm not sure how this applies at all. I'm not sure God's been faithful to me. I'm not sure I can find forgiveness or forgive someone else. Some of you are not married, but you want to be, and this just raises bitterness and resentment. Whatever the case, whatever the story, whatever the high, whatever the low, we begin and end with the gospel that God made a promise to you first. That his yes is stronger than your no. That his grace is more powerful than your sin, your shame, your brokenness. that his commitment keeps you even when your commitments fail. And all of ours do. And all of you have been through some moment, some situation like that. But we're here, and we give this message, and we call people to commit and renew that commitment and lean into commitment, not because we're religious. We do so because we know, we have hope, and we believe in this God who's committed us to us, who gave his life for us. Jesus on the cross saying not just, I love you or I forgive you, but I take you for better or for worse. That's his promise to you. So if you bow your heads and close your eyes and pray with me for just a moment. And as we pray, I want to invite you, I want to challenge you to consider some of the what-ifs that are going through your soul. And what if I get hurt in this relationship? Maybe your what-if is, what if this hurt I feel doesn't go away? Maybe you're thinking, what if this loneliness just can't be resolved? Maybe you're thinking, what if God can't fix or redeem or change the situation I'm in? Well, I want to challenge whatever what if you're thinking, I want to invite you to think of a new what if. What if God can? What if God does? What if God's grace is stronger than your sin? What if his yes is more powerful than your no? What if his commitment to you is more profound and powerful than any commitment you make? What would change? What would you do differently? What would you want to repent of? What would you want to commit to? Jesus, we bear our souls before you. You are the lover of our souls. You are the one who is truly committed in this room to each of us. No matter what our story or situation, no matter how much our hearts ache or break, your promise, your goodness, your grace, your love, your faithfulness never changes. And while our eyes can hit the floor, while our commitments can fall, your face never turns from us. There is no shadow of turning with you. And so, Jesus, right now, we want to receive that promise. We want to embrace that promise. We want to let that grace wash over us in a way that can change us and give us hope. And may our hope in you be what fuels the commitments we make, the commitments we keep, the commitments you call us to. And may we never forget that in this journey, you've gone first. You've said yes, that you take us for better, for worse, forever. And we pray this in your great name. Amen.